Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really significant and frankly ethically charged legal battle, People v. Kevorkian.
It's definitely a landmark case.
Yeah, and we've got quite a bit to work with, a detailed case brief, a standard legal brief, and even some notes breaking down the complexities. Our goal today is really to pull out the key legal and ethical takeaways, especially for, you know, listeners digging into this area of law.
And right off the bat, it's crucial to understand how the law often zeroes in on who performs that final act leading to death. That becomes really central here.
Absolutely. And this case, it just brings together so many critical areas. Criminal procedure, which for our audience is basically the rule book for how criminal cases proceed.
Oh, right, the steps involved.
Patient rights, the definition of end-of-life care. It's all wrapped up in this one situation.
And at the heart of it all is Dr. Jack Kevorkian. I mean, talk about a controversial figure.
Definitely. A very vocal proponent of physician-assisted suicide, really pushing the envelope, challenging the laws as they stood.
And the specific instance that led to this trial involves Thomas Uecke, who was suffering terribly from terminal ALS.
Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's just a devastating condition, progressively damaging nerve cells. Really tragic circumstances.
Truly. And this is where it gets legally critical. Kevorkian didn't just say, provide pills. He took direct action.
He administered the lethal drugs himself.
Yes, exactly. A cocktail Soconol, anectine, potassium chloride, given directly via injection. That direct administration is key.
And then there was the 60 Minutes broadcast. That just catapulted everything into the public eye, didn't it?
Oh, massively. It aired the actual video of Kevorkian administering the drugs. I mean, talk about evidence for the prosecution. It was right there on national television.
Wow. Okay, so let's unpack the charges then. The prosecution didn't just go for, like, an assisting suicide charge. They went for a second-degree murder. Why murder?
Well, that hits that core distinction we mentioned. Active euthanasia versus assisted suicide. You see, assisted suicide usually means the patient takes the final step, maybe swallows medication provided to them.
Okay.
But here, Kevorkian performed the final act. He pushed the plunger. Under Michigan law at the time, and it's still largely the case, active euthanasia, where someone else directly causes the death, wasn't permitted.
So his direct injection put it into the category of homicide under their laws.
Precisely. The law focused on who took that final action. That's the legal hook for the murder charge.
Got it. That's a really critical point for understanding this. And there was another charge too, right? Something about controlled substances.
Yeah, delivery of a controlled substance. That was separate but related. Soconol, anectine, these are regulated drugs.
Right.
Administering them outside of a legitimate medical purpose, as defined by Michigan law, was it illegal in itself? So even setting aside the cause of death, just giving those drugs in that context was a separate crime.
Okay. Now, moving to the trial itself, It sounds like it was pretty dramatic. Kevorkian made a huge call representing himself.
He did. Pro se, as they say. And it's incredibly risky, especially in a murder trial. The judge actually warned him about it, pointed out how complex the rules of evidence and procedure are. It's a defendant's right, sure, but often not the wisest path without legal training.
And a major point of conflict was the evidence, specifically testimony from Thomas Uecke's family about his suffering and his wish to die. That was excluded.
It was. And this really highlights a fundamental legal principle, even if it feels harsh from a human perspective.
How so?
Under Michigan law, then, consent wasn't a defense to murder, period. The court was very clear. Uecke's wishes, his suffering, his family's testimony about his consent, none of that could legally justify the act of homicide.
So the analogy they used, like consenting to having your wallet stolen, It doesn't make theft legal.
Exactly. The law prohibits the act itself, regardless of the victim's state of mind or consent in a situation like homicide. It's tough because you understand the human tragedy, Uecke's desire to end unbearable suffering.
Right, the emotional weight is immense.
But legally, for the murder charge as defined, it was considered irrelevant, a very stark legal reality.
So, the family's testimony about his pain and desire, while powerful, couldn't negate the illegality of Kevorkian's direct action under Michigan law.
That's how the court saw it, yes. And the procedural drama didn't stop there. During closing arguments, Kevorkian tried to bring in new information, essentially testifying without being under oath.
Ah, you can't do that here, even if you're representing yourself.
No, absolutely not. Closing arguments are for summarizing the evidence already presented and argued during the trial. You can't introduce new facts or your own unsworn testimony then.
Because it hasn't been tested by cross-examination.
Precisely. So the prosecutor objected, And the judge agreed, sustaining those objections. Everyone, even pro se defendants, has to follow the court's rules.
Makes sense. So the conviction happened, and then it went to the appeals court. What was their take?
The Michigan Court of Appeals upheld the convictions, both for the second-degree murder and the delivery of a controlled substance. They essentially said the trial court got it right.
And did they specifically address those objections during the closing arguments?
They did. They found the prosecutor's objections were perfectly valid. Kevorkian was trying to slide in new assertions of fact, acting like a witness during his closing. The appellate court confirmed that's not allowed.
Okay. And there was this other point about hybrid representation. Kevorkian had standby counsel, right? Like a backup lawyer?
Yes, he did have court-appointed standby counsel. But the issue was, could he later claim his standby counsel was ineffective, essentially blaming them for his own strategic choices? And the court applied this hybrid representation rule, basically saying, look, you chose to represent yourself. You waived your primary right to counsel.
You're driving the bus.
Exactly. You can't then turn around and claim your standby counsel, who is there to assist if requested, but not to run the show, provided ineffective assistance. By choosing self-representation, Kevorkian took on the responsibility and was bound by the same legal standards as any lawyer. He couldn't blame the backup.
So he made his bed, legally speaking, by choosing to go pro se.
That's the essence of the ruling on that point.
Okay, stepping back then, what's the bigger picture here? The lasting legal significance of People v. Kevorkian.
Well, it really cemented that line in Michigan law. Active euthanasia, directly causing death, is illegal homicide. It drew a clear distinction, legally speaking, from assisted suicide, where the patient takes the final action, the legality of that being a whole separate evolving debate state by state.
And it's a pretty cautionary tale about self-representation, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. It starkly illustrates the dangers. Navigating complex criminal law, evidence rules, procedure, it's incredibly difficult without training, even if you feel passionate about your case.
Definitely food for thought for any law student considering trial work.
Yeah.
Beyond the pure legal mechanics, though, this case just rips open huge ethical questions.
It really does. It puts that fundamental tension right in the spotlight.
Right.
Individuals' autonomy, their right to make decisions about their own life and death, especially in the face of terrible suffering.
Versus the state's interest in preserving life, in preventing homicide as defined by law.
Exactly. And this case, Kevorkian, became a flashpoint. It fueled the national conversation, and you can argue it influenced the later development of death with dignity laws in places like Oregon, which allow physician-assisted suicide under very strict conditions.
So to kind of wrap up the main points for everyone listening, this case confirmed active euthanasia was illegal homicide in Michigan at that time. It underscored the serious risks of self-representation in court.
Definitely.
And it threw these profound ethical dilemmas about end-of-life choices, patient autonomy, and the role of the law into sharp relief debates that are still very much alive today.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how one case can encapsulate so many enduring legal and moral struggles.
It truly is. Which leads to maybe a final thought for you, our listeners, to chew on. Considering how much things have evolved since Kevorkian's societal views, laws in some other states, what do you think are the most critical factors we should be focusing on now as we continue to navigate the legal and ethical landscape of end-of-life decisions? Something to really think about. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.